Number nine on our list, Carl Mays. Only seven pitchers won 200 or more games between 1915 and 1929, and they are all in the Hall except Carl Mays.
Wait a minute. I know this guy. This is the guy who killed Ray Chapman with a pitch in 1920. You want this guy in the Hall? Killing a man is a lesser offense than Pete Rose betting on baseball games?
If it was unintentional, it sure is. Mays was a submarine pitcher. Part of Chapman's success was that he crowded the plate, frequently got hit by pitches. There were witnesses at that game in 1920 who swore that if the ball had not hit Chapman, it could have been called a strike. The tragedy of Ray Chapman was magnified by the fact that he was one of the most popular players in the game. His wife was pregnant with their first child. Mays, in turn, was often gruff. He'd been involved in a near strike during the 1918 World Series. There was a huge controversy over his sale by the Red Sox to the Yankees a year later. It was your classic bad guy, good guy. And it has nothing to do with whether or not Carl Mays should be in Cooperstown. He was a 207 and 126 pitcher and a five-time 20-game winner. In a hitter's era, his career ERA was 291. Three of his contemporaries, all in the Hall, are well behind him. Numbers 10 and 11 are a group, John McSherry and Steve Palermo. For all the umpires who sweated and grunted under a weary life, who better to go to Cooperstown than McSherry, the man who died on the field on opening day in 1996. There are no stats for umps other than service. Mac was starting his 26th year, but reputation for an umpire is everything. Every National Leaguer I ever talked to said McSherry was never out of position for a call, never held a grudge against a manager or a player who beefed, and never was afraid to admit he might have missed one. Pitchers said his strike zone never varied, not from inning to inning, not from game to game. He deserves a plaque along with Steve Palermo, who was considered the best balls and strikes guy in the game and who was willing to sacrifice his safety, indeed his livelihood, to protect some strangers. Number 12, Fred Merkel. I've said and written a lot of things about Fred Merkel.
Here we go. Pardon me while I get nauseous.
As an 18-year-old with the New York Giants, starting for the first time in a big league game, Fred Merkel got a critical two-out single in the bottom of the ninth of a 1-1 tie against the Cubs, the Giants' chief rival for the pennant in that season of 1908. Merkel's hit into the right field corner at the Polo Grounds sent the winning run, Moose McCormick, to third. Al Bridwell followed with the apparent game-winning hit, and the Giants had a victory vital to their pennant race. Then, as now, there was a rule on the books that said a run could not score on the third out of an inning if the third out comes on a force play. But in situations like the one in which young Fred found himself that unforgettable Wednesday afternoon, the rule was never enforced. The moment the winning run scored in 1908, your game was over. It had to be over, because the fans customarily ran to the exits, across the field to the exits. For their own safety, the players were encouraged to get to the clubhouse as quickly as they could. The clubhouses in the Polo Grounds in New York were in dead center field, so as soon as McCormick crossed the plate, Merkel and all his teammates took off on a dead run for center field. Unfortunately, Fred, breaking from first with Bridwell's hit, apparently took off long before he actually advanced to second base. And somehow, in the chaos that ensued, the Cubs made a force play on him at second, the umpires declared him out, and nullified the run. The National League president, Harry Pulliam, ordered the game replayed if and only if the Cubs and the Giants wound up tied for the pennant.
Which, of course, they did.
And when the Cubs won the replay, poor Merkel, victim of a rule that had never been previously enforced, was blamed. They called him Bonehead for the rest of his career. And he managed to last another 14 seasons in the big leagues. He played on six pennant winners, and he finished up a fine ball player. I think Fred Merkel's perseverance in staying in the game by itself merits his inclusion in Cooperstown. But of course, it turns out Fred's stats do some further arguing still. In his years as an everyday player, 1910 to 1920, he's fifth in doubles in that era, sixth in slugging, eighth in average, 10th in homers, 10th in total bases, 12th in hits, 12th in stolen bases, 13th in RBI, 16th in runs scored, and all of this after the 1908 incident. Now, one last footnote about Merkel. The team that got the previously unenforced rule enforced on him, the Cubs, they went on to win the World Series that year, and the bastards haven't won one since. All right, number 13 of 15, Milt Pappas. In his Bible on the subject of Cooperstown, The Politics of Glory, the great Bill James points out...
Wait, you're not going to put him in. Don't you remember the trade? I was 9 years old. The Reds sent Frank Robinson to Baltimore for Milt Pappas. Robbie won the Triple Crown and the Orioles swept the World Series.
Dan, get over it. Blame Bill DeWitt for that trade. He made the deal, not Milt Pappas. Anyway, Bill James said it this way. Look at the careers of two pitchers. Pitcher A has 209 wins and 166 losses and 465 starts. Pitcher B has 209 wins, 164 losses, 465 starts. Pitcher A has 3,432 innings. He has 2,486 strikeouts. He has 858 walks. Pitcher B has 3,046 innings pitched. He has 1,728 strikeouts, and he has 855 walks. Pitcher A has a lifetime ERA of 3.40, which was about 11% better than the average for his time in his league. Pitcher B had a lifetime ERA of 2.95, which was about 21% better than the average for his time in his league. Pitcher B is Milt Pappas, and pitcher A is Don Drysdale, Hall of Famer. Could any two contemporary guys generate career stats that match any more closely? Other than the strikeouts and the ERA, the numbers are twins. So why is Drysdale in Cooperstown and Pappas simply the second half of the Frank Robinson trade story? Number 14, Veda Pinson.
Oh, no. Here we go. You're going to get us in trouble again, aren't you? Remember, Robin Yount was about to get his 3,000th hit, and you had us take a closer look at how Yount compared to Pinson and a couple of other guys. And I had to say the tough stuff. I got 4 billion letters from everybody in Wisconsin saying we had some nerve saying Robin Yount was not a Hall of Famer, which is not what we were trying to do.
Everybody has a role in life, Dan, and yours is taking my bad mail. Look, I never said Robin Yount wasn't a Hall of Famer. And to be truthful, Dan, you never said Robin Yount wasn't a Hall of Famer. What I said was the only difference between Robin Yount and Veda Pinson was that Yount was going to cross a magic number that everybody knew about. 3,000 hits. Real easy to remember. 3,000. Pinson hadn't done that, and that was a damned shame. One of my favorite books when I was a kid was a thing the Sporting News put out called Daguerreotypes of Great Stars of Baseball. It contained the career stats for all the guys in the hall, plus all the other reasonable candidates. Any hitter who reached any of the following four criteria was in this book. Hit 300 for at least 10 years, play in 2,000 games, get 2,000 hits, or hit 200 homers. Veda did them all except the 300 part. Between 1959 and 1975, only four guys managed to come to the plate even 6,000 times and hit 300. And in that context, Veda's 286 over 9,645 at-bats looks pretty damn good. Old first ballot Robin Yount had three more full seasons than Pinson. Veda nonetheless outdid him in homers, in stolen bases, in slugging percentage, and in batting average. The argument is not that Yount doesn't deserve a spot in Cooperstown. It is that he and Pinson both deserve a spot in Cooperstown. All right, 15, Ron Santo. Bill James considers him probably the greatest player not in the hall. In just 15 years, he had 342 homers, the most for anybody in his era who was not a first baseman or an outfielder. He drove in 1,331 runs, which is fifth for anybody in his era and first among the nons. Well, even if he'd been a first baseman, he'd probably be a serious Cooperstown candidate. He was a third baseman, though, good enough to have won five straight gold gloves. This was a remarkable, consistent ball player whose absence from the hall is enough by itself to make us question whether or not the writers should continue to do the voting.
Pardon me for interrupting, but are you finished?
Yes. I can't believe, though, how many guys I had to leave out. Vida Blue, Rocky Colavito, George Stacy Davis, Joe Gordon, mm-hmm. Stan Hack, Gil Hodges, mm-hmm. Herman Long, Roger Maris, Bill Mazeroski,
yep.
Don Newcomb, Tony Oliva,
mm-hmm.
Louis Tiant, Bill White.
Yeah, got it up to 40. Happy now?
Not really.
You've heard Keith's whines about the hall. Allow me to complain. And I know I'm probably in the minority, but I don't care what an athlete makes. I don't want to know what an athlete makes. People come up to me all the time and ask, is such and such worth X number of dollars? Well, if somebody's willing to pay, then you're worth it. If you're not worth it, they don't pay. Plain and simple. You get what the market bears. People say, oh, is Michael Jordan worth $25 million? No. He's worth twice that. At least to the Chicago Bulls, to the city of Chicago, to the NBA, to the global empire of the NBA. Is Juwan Howard worth $100 million? It's hard to put that in perspective. What does $100 million mean to you or me? It's a lot of money. But how do the Bullets recoup that? I once asked the Braves' Tom Glavine if it bothered him that people knew exactly how much he made. After all, it's in the newspaper. And he said, yes, it bothers me, because I don't go up to my neighbor and say, what do you make? Why are people so obsessed with knowing what I make? And he's right. I feel like it's an intrusion in a lot of ways. There are, however, some secondary reasons that I believe suggests that salaries should be revealed, among them if it affects what your team can do under a salary cap. Say you've signed Deion Sanders for X number of dollars, and you therefore can't afford to go out and get defensive linemen. Well, you as a fan would probably want to know that, so I understand those things. Sometimes I wonder if the salary cap will be the end of the world. One day, every corporation, never mind every team, is going to have a salary cap. Well, I'm sorry, we can only offer you $72, Mr. Patrick. We have a salary cap here at ESPN. We went out and had to re-sign Chris Berman, and that's all the money we have left. Or, you're over the salary cap here at Happy's Wholesome Bakery. We re-signed the Swedish chef. You get $239.27 a week. That's all we have left. The analogy I like to use when people point out how much an athlete makes is Bruce Springsteen can make $40 million on the Born in the USA tour. Now, what's the difference between him as an entertainer and, say, Magic Johnson, Hakeem Olajuwon, or Michael Jordan? They are all entertainers. Well, you say Michael's just one player. He has a team behind him. Springsteen doesn't. Ever heard of Clarence Clemens on the saxophone? And I know what the average fan's argument is. Well, we would play for nothing. Would you really want to go through all that a professional athlete has to go through for free? For much, much less than the team is making from you? Play a rain-delayed game in Montreal one night, leave at 3 in the morning for Chicago, play a day game at Wrigley the next afternoon, year after year, with your job performance judged by millions, booed, reported on TV, with sports writers, stalkers, the chance you could turn a corner, rip a hamstring, and get fired because you run 10% slower than you did the previous year, with your career lasting an average of 4 or 5 years, after you put in 10 or 15 years of preparing for it, sacrificing the rest of your life for it, for free, for less? Sorry to get serious. Would you have traded places with, say, Donnie Moore? Remember him? The Angels, a strike away from going to the World Series in 1986, and Donnie Moore gives up a two-run homer to Dave Henderson of the Red Sox. The Angels lose the game, lose the series, and Donnie Moore spends the rest of his life dwelling on it, reliving it. He's booed, not viciously, not even more than average, but something slowly snaps, and not even 3 years later, he takes a shot at his wife, missing, thank God, and then kills himself. I think when you begin to look at the price tag affixed to an athlete, you begin to expect certain things you never expected before. I think we, reporters and fans, have to be careful with that. We become highly critical because our player is not performing like a $100 million ball player should. Blame management for signing him, for spending that kind of money. I look at a friend of mine, Jeff Blauzer of the Braves, a marginal player, a little better than average shortstop, starting for a great team. All of a sudden, he hits arbitration. He's making $3 million a year. Well, he started to really press. I don't know if he's ever recovered from that. I think he still tries too hard to live up to making $3 million a year. Where I think today's ballplayers deserve criticism is in how they've responded to their own success and their own celebrity. We want athletes to be entertainers, and there's a fine line between showbiz and showing up another ballplayer. When I see Henry Rodriguez stand at the plate and admire a home run, I say, who is Henry Rodriguez to do that? It's a great story that Henry Rodriguez had a career year for the Expos last year. You would think that a guy who's been through all that he's been through, the hardships, the troubles, the problems with injuries, that he would be a little bit more humble. It's usually the guys who are not worthy who wind up doing most of the showboating. Now, Pete Maravich was as good as it got when it came to entertaining. But I think Maravich was not about showing you up as much as he was all about knowing he had to put on a show. That's what he was all about in college. And when he got to the NBA, he knew that's what he was being paid to do. Perform. Be an entertainer. The long hair. The floppy socks. The great passes. The wild shots. But it's not like he got in your face and taunted you. Some people, even players, suggest this all started with Julius Irving. Any athlete who feels this way saw only Dr. J's sizzle and not his steak. Anything you have to do to beat the other guy, twisting in midair, changing hands at the hoop, slam dunking, is fair game. If it looks flashy, if it looks amazing, that's fine. That's part of the game. Julius Irving didn't land from a slam dunk and bump chest with his teammates or shoot imaginary six guns at his opponents. Now you see athletes who act almost as if it's scripted. This is how I'm going to dance after I do this. Barry Sanders, who's been a friend of mine since he left Oklahoma State, does not spike the football after a touchdown. He's told me, I don't know what I would do if I tried to do it. I'd look silly if I did a touchdown dance. What he won't tell you is that he wants to act like he's been in the end zone before. He is so flashy when he runs that he might show you up. He might embarrass you, but only with his God-given ability while trying to avoid tackles. Consider the other Sanders. Deion Sanders knows what it takes to sell. Sell himself. A product, just like Dennis Rodman. They're businessmen. I think both of their histrionics are overbearing at times, but people, you, the fan, pay to see them. If people saw Deion Sanders as just the person, not the ball player, they wouldn't even know him. A concerned father, a guy who loves to go fishing, a self-admitted bore. When Rodman was with the Pistons, he was a good player on a great team, but he was not a star. All of a sudden, Dennis started piercing every part of his body that he could, tattoos all over his body, changing his hair color. And then he became a superstar. I mean, he's La Cage aux Folles on a basketball floor. ESPN and every other television outfit in this country deserves part of the blame that goes around on this. We show the athletes. They see those highlights. They think, if I'm going to be on the show, I've got to do that as well. So I take part of the blame, just by proxy. I try to be fair in making those observations about showboating because it is a different world today for the athlete. It's kind of sad when I isolate an athlete like Barry Sanders because he simply hands the football back to the official after scoring a touchdown. It's the period at the end of a sentence. I've done my job. I've scored. Here's the football. I plan on being back. So as fans, reporters, and athletes, let's make a contract. We'll stop harping on how much money players make when their employers always make more from them. But you athletes have to stop showing people up. The money should be enough. So should the touchdown you've just scored or the home run you've just hit.
We wanted to take some space to pay tribute to the people who our jobs are really all about, the athletes themselves. We wanted to include one list of top 10 admired favorite sports figures. First, you'll hear Dan's choice, then you'll hear my answer, then my choice, and then his answer.
And we did agree immediately on someone who should be at the top of every list like this.
As Howard Cosell always used to call him, Jack Roosevelt Robinson.
For all the problems that still exist in this country, for all the racism in both directions, for all the bigotry and the idiocy, imagine what everything would be like if half a century ago, Jackie Robinson hadn't done what he did and hadn't done it the way he did. It's amazing that so many athletes, especially baseball players, don't know his story, don't know his sacrifice.
I wonder sometimes if that isn't a sign of progress that they don't. Don't get me wrong. I feel there's not just racial pride, but great human warmth in the fact that Mo Vaughn chooses to wear number 42 because Robinson did, or in the fact that I could sit down with David Cohn in spring training and he could go on in amazement about Jackie Robinson. But the ultimate goal is supposed to be a time when nobody can really believe that only white men played Major League Baseball for the 60-odd years before Jackie Robinson broke in with the Dodgers in 1947. My mom always said that the goal of being a parent is to make yourself obsolete. Maybe, long-term, Jackie Robinson's goal was to make himself, in the social sense, obsolete.
And when we reach that goal, he'll still be on the top of the list. For personal courage, for being a revolutionary ball player.
Amen. So let's go to our top 10 of everybody else. The first selection belongs to Dan Patrick.
Thank you. Number one, Kirby Puckett, a man of his word. When he signed his contract, he lived up to it. Even though he knew he was vastly underpaid the day he signed it, played with enthusiasm. You never heard a negative word about Kirby Puckett. He was a winner, a Hall of Famer. And when he knew he couldn't play anymore, he bowed out with such dignity. He stayed with the same team. He stayed with the Twins his entire career. I knew I always got my money's worth when I watched Kirby Puckett play. He always looked like he was trying. He always looked like he was having fun.
The saddest part about Puckett is that when he had to quit, he still had it, except for his vision. Not a tragedy on the Lou Gehrig level, but at least as sad an occurrence as Sandy Koufax having to give it up at the age of 31. That having been said, the guy on top of my list is still Jim Thorpe. There has never been a greater athlete, there has never been a more influential athlete, and there has never been a more tragic athlete. A kid off the native reservations in Oklahoma becomes the greatest college football player of his day. Running, kicking, punting, playing defense. Then he concentrates on his hobby, track and field, and he goes and wins the decathlon and the heptathlon at the 1912 Olympics. Wins every speed event, every durability event. Then they find out he made $60 a month one summer, 3 years before playing baseball in the lowest of the minor leagues, and they strip his Olympic medals from him. He's hurt, he's devastated, so he goes pro in baseball and football at the same time for 10 years. Now, he was only an average outfielder, but what he did in college football for Carlisle, he repeated in the years in which the NFL was being formed. In fact, in the first year of the NFL, he was the star player. He was also the coach of his team. He was also the league's president. As late as 1950, Jim Thorpe was voted, one, the greatest college football player of all time, two, the greatest pro football player of all time, three, the greatest Olympian of all time, four, the greatest track and field athlete of all time, and five, the greatest athlete of the first half of the 20th century. When I was with CNN, Fred Lebow of the New York Marathon held a 90th birthday party for a man named Abel Kibiat, who was one of the great distance runners before the First World War. Abel had been Jim Thorpe's roommate at the Stockholm Olympics in 1912. What a thrill this was. Kvyat insisted the only reason they didn't enter Jim Thorpe in all the track and field events at those Olympics was simply to give the other Americans a chance at a medal or two. He said Thorpe was actually greater than any of the records suggest. All Thorpe had to do was watch you do something, practice it once, and then he'd be better than you were. He told me Thorpe could have watched me do the interview we were doing, then taken the mic out of my hand and done my job better than I did.
I'm supposed to be impressed by that?
I saw that cab coming down Broadway with its doors open. Anyway, pick up your list.
Number two, Michael Jordan. He is the man every single night out. He knows that he has to be the star. He has to entertain. When he comes to town, people come out to see Michael Jordan. He may be the greatest basketball player we've ever seen, but money was not the issue with Michael. He wanted to win. He knew that's how you recognize greatness. Criticized the Bulls his first couple of years there because he wanted to be surrounded by better players. He was willing to reduce his salary so other players could be brought in. To know that you're going to be the villain every single night when you go to the opposing arena, and to love being that guy, to savor it, to put the dagger into the other team's heart, that is sports. That is being an athlete.
I would put Mike somewhere on my list, but I cannot rate him ahead of my second choice, Muhammad Ali. Forget what he did in the ring. It is very possible that Marciano might have floored him, or Tyson, or whoever. You can even forget that he lost four prime years of his career because he stood up for some very unpopular principles of a very unpopular religion for a very unpopular race of people. You can even forget that after that persecution, he came back and he won his championship all over again twice. I put him on this list simply because of an indescribable magic he could and still can use on everyday people. My agent, Gene Sage, once was riding in a limo with him, and he got out at a traffic light. Within a minute, he was surrounded by 1,000 people. They came out of the office buildings. Drivers jumped out of their cabs. A mounted policeman got off his horse. Just to be near Ali, just to see him. When he spoke, they all became silent. When he said he had to go, nobody protested. Nobody asked for one more autograph. They just spontaneously started chanting his name.
We saw a microcosm of that at the ESPYs in 1996. I do have a slight problem with him making millions in this country and then refusing to go to war, at least trying to do what Elvis Presley did by serving in the military.
Fair enough. But you know damn well it was no coincidence that after converting to being a Muslim, he just happens to be drafted when he's 8 years older than the standard age. Anyway, throw in the Olympic gold medal and what he meant to his race and the fact that he might be the greatest boxer of all time, and you have yourself one of the greatest people of all time.
My number three is Cal Ripken. You and I go back and forth on Cal's value, Cal's streak. It's hard to criticize somebody for wanting to play. There were times when arrest probably would have done him good. As he rationalizes it, though, who was better than me in the lineup at that position? Even if I am tired, who is better than me? I found him to be sincere, genuine, and a person who loved to compete, loved to beat you, no matter what. Now, it's not going to say that I don't appreciate what Lou Gehrig did, and you've updated me, clued me in, on what Gehrig was going through at the time of his streak.
I'm criticizing Cal Ripken, and I criticized him only for his lack of knowledge of who Lou Gehrig was, so I have to take Lou Gehrig over him at number three. In 95, I suggested that Cal should consider tying Gehrig's streak and then intentionally sitting out game 21-31, because I thought if Cal only knew about Lou Gehrig, he would have wanted to see Lou Gehrig's name stay in the record book.
But the only thing is, Lou Gehrig would have wanted Cal Ripken to play, because that's what the streak was all about. I agree with you partially on that. Cal said he didn't know that much about Lou Gehrig other than he was a great ball player.
Gehrig's streak did not end the way Ripken's streak will end. It did not end because the Yankees found somebody better, or because Lou Gehrig got hurt, or because Lou Gehrig simply didn't have it anymore. It ended because Lou Gehrig was dying of a terrible, debilitating disease. The day Gehrig's streak ended, the Yankees beat the Tigers 22-2, and each inning they would plead with him to come in for an inning or pinch hit or do something to keep the streak alive, and Gehrig just kept shaking his head and telling his replacement, Babe Dahlgren, it's over. I can't do it anymore. And we know Lou Gehrig didn't suddenly get ALS in 1939 and die 2 years later. That's not the way that terrible disease happens. He must have had it in 1935, or 1933, or 1929, for all we know. Lou Gehrig was dying while he played the last 500 or 1,000 games of his streak. Can you imagine this? You talk about players coming out of the lineup for silly injuries. This man did not come out of the lineup while his bones were disintegrating and his muscular coordination was literally dissolving. There has been nothing comparable to that. And Cal Ripken or no Cal Ripken, as much respect as I have for him, there will never be anything comparable to that.
Number four on my list is Barry Sanders. I find him to be naive at times, but he's also a great practical joker. He loves to kid, loves to act like he doesn't know what you're talking about. The first time I met him, I wasn't sure if he was being serious with me. He had just won the Heisman, and the first thing he did was look at what I was wearing. He said, "Do you think I'll ever be able to afford suits like that?" I didn't realize he was being serious. He didn't have a suit. He came from modest means. His car had actually broken down on the day he went to announce that he was going pro. And still, money has never been an issue to him. I remember he fretted over buying a new Honda because he thought it looked too gaudy, too ritzy. Meanwhile, his teammates were driving Mercedes and BMWs. During his rookie year with the Lions, I went to do a story on Barry in Detroit. I said, "Barry, we'd like to get some videotape of you walking into practice." And he begged me not to, because he didn't want to be singled out on his team.
A great athlete and a humble guy, and that's a very endearing personality trait.
One neither one of us has.
Yes. No time for false modesty. Back to the list. Number four, Martina Navratilova. I always refer to her on the air as my hero, and I mean this. How many athletes have been in the public eye so long, under such trying circumstances, done so well in their sport, and maintained their dignity and their sense of humor? One of the funniest people I've ever known, forever making jokes at her own expense, admitting to a lifestyle that probably dozens of pros in all sports have kept secret, and then becoming politically active about it. All those years when she wore the black hat to Chris Everett's Good Little Girl routine.
My number five is Wayne Gretzky, the greatest hockey player of all time.
Whoa, hold on, stop right there.
No.
The greatest player of all time?
Yes.
The greatest scorer of all time. Gordie Howe was a greater player against tougher competition. Bobby Orr was a greater player. Probably Bobby Hull, maybe even Mark Messier. And this reign in which he owned the league, it was over by the time he got to Los Angeles. He has been slowing down ever since.
Of course he's slowed down. See, now you got me going. He's been carrying the league for over a decade. What he did as a player will never be matched. He dominated. Everybody knew what he was going to do, and they couldn't stop him. He's another athlete who would stay there until the last question was asked. He tried to be interesting with his answers. He was selling a league. He was trying to keep it afloat. And as to his goal scoring, it's not like this was the era of the juiced puck, please.
Oh, yes, it was, as is evidenced with my number five, Gordie Howe. Think about this. Gordie Howe scored over 1,000 goals lifetime, and the first 600-plus were in a six-team league. This meant that every night, Gordie Howe was going up against one of the six best goalies in the world. He was going up against four of the 24 best defensemen in the world. He was going up against one of the six best teams in the world. There were two seasons in the 50s when every single goaltender Gordie Howe scored against went on to the Hockey Hall of Fame.
Don't raise your voice at me.
And Howe kept himself in condition long enough to play from 1946 through 1980. To play long enough to be a threat offensively and defensively while his own kids were playing alongside of him.
I saw what he did to you in the ESPN commercial, too.
Every time he had to hold on to me, it was like a vice. The man was 68 years old, and a half an hour after we finished shooting the spot, just his grip had been so strong that I began to hurt from the tip of my finger to the back of my neck. And he was a gentleman, too. Cordial, cooperative, thanked everybody for letting him do the commercial with me.
I don't mean to discredit him. I'm just saying, Wayne Gretzky, to me, carried a league and was the greatest player of all time.
But in the 40s and the 50s, when the NHL had been a dozen-team league and was gradually, slowly going out of business, Gordie Howe and the people of his era saved the NHL.
The people of his era. Wayne Gretzky was the person of his era.
Who's that Lemieux guy with Pittsburgh? Move on to number six.
Number six is Larry Joe Bird. I've always appreciated athletes who make it look easy, like Wayne Gretzky. Athletes who are able to make others better, like Wayne Gretzky. Athletes who break the game down to a science, like Pete Rose, and have fun doing so. Athletes who do things that not everybody else can. We don't see these athletes too often, and Bird was always one of those players. He and Magic Johnson, the two best players I've ever seen in finding the right guy at the right time. Not just the open man, but the right guy who had the best chance of scoring. To watch him play in person, up close, was to get a true sense of what greatness is in the variety of things that go into making up a tremendous athlete. He was one of the greatest players ever. Also a character, too. Great sense of humor, great at needling people.
Like Gordie Howe. Well, all right, he's on my list, but my number six is completely out of left field. Jim Boughton, one of the best pitchers in baseball for a couple of years, and he gutted out another five or six seasons with his arm virtually scotch-taped back onto his shoulder. And in 1978, out of the major leagues for 8 years, at the age of 39, he went back to the beginning, to the low minor leagues, just so he could enjoy the whole process all over again. And he actually got to the Braves and actually won a game. Of course, he's not on this list because of all that. He's on this list because of his book, Ball 4. The first book about what it was really like to be a pro athlete. The boredom, the practical jokes, the hatreds, the goofing around, the travel, the women. He showed us that the players were not superhumans or even gods. They were just grown-ups. And anybody with some talent and some perseverance could become one of them. There's a great deal in there in a very kind of subtle way about working hard and how to overcome adversity. And, of course, it's as funny as hell. And there's something else. He became a sportscaster in New York, and what a revelation that was. When his former teammate Jimmy Wynn got stabbed in the stomach by his wife Ruth on their anniversary, he says, "Ruth should know that the traditional gift on your seventh anniversary is not steel, but copper." Wow. Imagine seeing that when you're a kid like I did. I mean, highlights and jokes and substantive commentary. Dan, get us back to this list in a hurry.
Before I do, though, if people could have seen you in 1995 at the Sports Emmys, I've never seen you speechless. When you met Jim Boughton, you were mumble mouth that night.
And he said, "I'm a big fan of yours, and the only thing I could get out was, you should be. I've been doing your act since 1975. Back to the list.
Back to the list. Number seven, Arthur Ashe. I have admiration for the athlete, something more for the person. He was always this dignified, refined gentleman. Every time I spoke to him, he reminded me of royalty. He wanted to make a difference in the world, playing in a predominantly white sport, being ostracized, and then to emerge on the center court at Wimbledon, and then to win. Being a black man in America, he once said, is like having another full-time job. Fellow tennis player Yannick Noah said Ashe was a role model. Not as a tennis player, but as a person. There were other tennis players you wanted to be like, said Noah, but as a person, you wanted to be like Arthur Ashe. What greater tribute can a man receive?
I will agree with you on Arthur, and then I'm going to get us into trouble by picking the next one. Magic Johnson. I have never been a huge hoops fan, yet I got to watch Irvin every night for six seasons in Los Angeles. And that big smile was worth sweating through the Laker locker room, and he constantly tried to be nice and accommodating. Well, that's a bad choice of words. To fans and reporters alike. But that's not why he's on this list. I think he bit off more than he could chew when he said he planned to devote his life to being a spokesperson about HIV and AIDS. He didn't do the kind of upfront official stuff that has far more impact on the problem than he could ever imagine. But he's on this list because of something that happened in Los Angeles. When I was working there, there was a sports figure whose family lost an individual in the family to AIDS. And all they announced was that he had died of complications of dehydration and pneumonia. And I announced that the way the family wanted it. Legally and ethically, that's all we could do. The phone rang as soon as I was off the air, and it was a woman whose brother had been in the AIDS hospice in the next bed to the individual who had died. And she said, "This is like reliving my brother's death all over again. They don't have to make a big speech about what caused his death. They don't have to make a big deal about it or a donation or anything. Couldn't they just say, he died of AIDS?" And how many people would then think of it for the first time that AIDS could wind up in any household under any circumstances, even to this all-American sports family? And she said, if one person thought of that and didn't get the disease as a result, was that not enough to make some meaning of the death both of this young man and of her own brother? So when Magic Johnson stepped to that podium, that's what I was thinking of. 4 months after this fact, Irvin stood up, and he smiled, and he said he was HIV positive, and he was going to fight, and we should all be careful. Maybe Magic is no hero for getting the disease or for spreading it, but facing up to it, bringing it out into the open, when, let's be honest, he could have been playing all these years and we wouldn't have known a thing. That one moment is a heroic act. How many lives do you have to save to be a hero? One is enough, I think.
Number 8, Jackie Joyner Kersee. And I guess it's only appropriate that she's named after the former First Lady, Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis, because she was the First Lady of track and field, just a graceful athlete, and she wasn't in the glamour events. The heptathlon is hardly a glamour event, though she made it so. In fact, she used to have to explain what the heptathlon was. If you look at the accumulation of what she's done over her athletic career, nobody can touch her. Longevity counts for something. And one of the nicest, sweetest people you ever meet. When I interviewed her in Los Angeles, she said she wanted to seem mean to her competition, but she just didn't have it in her. Competitiveness and hatred don't have to be the same thing, and competitiveness and compassion don't have to be opposites. Here's another one out of left field for Keith.
Number 8, Jack Twyman, a 6-time NBA All-Star, Hall of Famer, but that has very little to do with why he's on my list. Late in the 1957-58 season, one of the early power forwards in the NBA, Maurice Stokes, suddenly went into convulsions on a Cincinnati Royals team flight. Not long after they landed, Stokes' illness was diagnosed as encephalitis, sleeping sickness. He would be hospitalized, virtually incapacitated, for the rest of his life. Stokes and Jack Twyman had hardly even been good friends, yet Twyman, who was white, had himself appointed legal guardian for Stokes, who was black. He raised funds to pay Stokes' medical bills. He inaugurated the Big Mo game at a resort in the New York Catskills, a charity game featuring NBA players that's still being held today. Jack Twyman took these responsibilities on himself simply because he felt somebody should do it.
And growing up, they were both heroes to us, but being in Cincinnati, even more so of an impact on my life. Number 9, Dick Trickle. He began as a curiosity in 1985. Well, at least in my mind, perusing through the sports sections in Atlanta, NASCAR town, I couldn't help but notice the name Dick Trickle. My God, how could his parents name him Dick Trickle? Better yet, how could he keep the name Dick Trickle as a grown-up? So I began to follow his career. Something would always happen to Dick. There was some excitement last year in Milwaukee. Dick back in his home state. Dick with a chance to win the race. Everybody in the entire ESPN newsroom called me, sent a message via computer. Dick Trickle was leading. I almost felt like a proud father. Of course, as soon as I turned on the race, he crashed. He was okay. Dick Trickle is the Charlie Brown of NASCAR. Charlie Brown behind the wheel, and the rest of the NASCAR field is Lucy, ready to pull the football right out from underneath him. So when he tries to kick it, every year, he falls flat on his face. But I did get to see Dick at Daytona this year. He came up and gave me a hug. He says, "I think you like me. But boy, you've helped my career. These people don't know if I'm a good race driver, but they know I got a funny name. Thanks."
He has taken a lot of, there is no other word for this, crap from us.
He's been a good sport about it, too. I did a radio interview with him, and he was down to earth. He had fun with it. He knew that it was kind of a strange name. He had been teased all of his life. And the amazing thing is that Dick Trickle was one of the greatest short track racers in his native Wisconsin. For all the kidding, he is basically the kind of sports figure upon which the whole edifice rests.
I completely concur with our friend's place on the list. Nonetheless, my entry at number 9, Ed Jockeman. What a goalie. To be a hockey fan in New York in the 1960s was to be a fan of steady Eddie Jockeman. No matter how the Rangers might disappoint in the playoffs, his abilities were a point of pride to us. But after 10 years with the Rangers, Eddie was sold on waivers to Detroit. The chance of Eddie had more often as not been replaced by booing at Madison Square Garden. But it turned out that Jockeman's first NHL game in a uniform other than New York's just happened to be at Madison Square Garden, and one of the most amazing things in sports history happened. The Rangers were booed from the moment they hit the ice. When Jockeman led the Red Wings out of the visitors' tunnel, the fans rose as one and roared and would not stop. The Eddie chant rang louder than it ever had before. It continued for the entire game. Eddie Jockeman wept openly during this game. He had to take off his mask a dozen times to wipe the tears. He won the game, and afterwards he wept again in the locker room, and it had such an effect on him that years later he told me he would never go back to the Garden to play ever again. He owed it to the fans who were there that night. Okay, DP, time for your last entry.
Number 10, Coach Reeves from the White Shadow. If not for the tragic knee injury that he suffered while playing for the Bulls, he may have been Michael Jordan. Coach Reeves, the next Mark Oberding, or maybe the next Mark Iveroni. He could do it all. But he did something after the injury that not many athletes are capable of doing, blending into society, giving something back. And you know, he ran that Carver High School basketball team to perfection.
You understand that was just a TV show, right?
So? We're a TV show.
I hadn't thought of it that way. All right, I have the last submission, and I will take my 10th pick from beyond even my customary place out in left field. Grover Powell. He won exactly one game in a big league career that lasted exactly 50 innings. In his first big league start, New York Mets, 1963, he shut out the Phillies 4-0. Hurt his arm in Venezuela that winter, never made it back to the major leagues. Well, given time, Grover Powell might have been a fine pitcher and an even finer example of the kind of player we love. Gifted, but not too serious about himself. He loved to, no other word for it, mess with reporters. Asked if he saw a line drive off the bat of Don Clendenin of the Pirates that struck him in the cheek, he said, "Yeah, he did. I saw the ball. I kept telling it to go back." Grover Powell died of leukemia at the age of 44. On his tombstone is etched an image of him in a New York Met uniform, and above the epitaph, which reads, "He achieved his dreams," is a copy of his lone baseball card. I think of Grover Powell just about any time I see a player make his debut, no matter which sport. You've heard Dan's concern about salaries and showboating. Well, this is one of my concerns. In April of 1987, when I worked in Southern California, I hurried home one Monday night to watch Nightline because they had planned a tribute to the 40th anniversary of Jackie Robinson's debut with the Dodgers. And I saw Al Campanis, Jackie's old double play partner with the Montreal Royals, a man I knew, a man I respected, explaining how blacks didn't have the necessities to become big league managers and executives. And after I had picked up my jaw from where it had fallen to the floor, I called the assignment desk at the radio station that I worked for, KNX. At 5 o'clock in the morning and again at 8, the listeners to the top all-news radio station in Los Angeles heard me become the first reporter to demand Al Campanis' resignation as the general manager of the Dodgers. When this happened in 1987, it was still something, for me personally, of a stance. I had never seen outright prejudice. Certainly, as white a white guy who ever lived, I never felt it. In 1990, I moved to a condo right on the border between Beverly Hills and Los Angeles, and then, as now, I worked at night. And usually, just to avoid the crowds, I would do my food shopping after I got home from the job. At 12:30 in the morning, or 1 o'clock, or at 5 if it had been an especially bad night, I would walk over and trudge back with my armfuls of groceries. All right, armfuls of snack foods. Perhaps the second or third time I ever did this, I noticed a police car on the Beverly Hills side of the line following slowly behind me. I crossed that imaginary boundary into L.A. just short of the corner of Beverly and Doheny. The car hooked a left at the intersection, I did my shopping, and I began to walk back. The second I crossed back into Beverly Hills, the police car reappeared from the opposite direction. Well, the third time this happened, it finally dawned on me what was going on. A rather large man walking in the shadows of Beverly Hills after midnight. They were checking to see if I was black. The night that they got that Rodney King beating tape, KTLA television in Los Angeles did not run it in even the first 15 minutes of their newscast. It was aired about half an hour into the show, and not because of some psycho manager's idea of when the maximum audience hit or anything like that. It was run then because, as shocking as were the images on the tape, there was an instinctive understanding on the part of the producers that the audience in Southern California was all too familiar with what they would be seeing. This was atrocious, but it was not necessarily breaking news. Let me take you back to that intersection of Beverly and Doheny in Los Angeles. One afternoon, I happened to notice a few police cars sort of filling up the intersection, say about 20 of them. There was a big old tree in front of the apartment building on the northwest corner, and there was a dark-skinned gentleman whom I might best describe as being attached to the tree. However the police had hooked him up to that tree, he had to be mighty uncomfortable as a result, and I don't think the 20 or 30 cops with their weapons pulled made him feel any better. Now, for all I know, this guy had just wiped out a mosque, but I couldn't help thinking about my midnight forays to the supermarket, often going right past that very tree. If I ran into a couple of legally blind L.A. cops one dark and foggy night and I couldn't prove I was white, might I wind up embracing that same tree?